partnership. Okay, great. And we'll send out the link following the call so you can share that recording with your staff and for any of our communities who weren't able to be on, and also an evaluation of the call, because we always seek feedback and ideas for future technical assistance. Caroline Schauer, our contract officer, was not able to be on the call today. She's traveling in between sites, but she wishes everyone well. And we will have a discussion led by Jim Creel, and then some time for questions, and then we have a few updates, and then we'll just kind of do a round robin and share with each other how things are going. And I think I'll let Kimmy introduce Jim.
Yes, we have had the pleasure of working with Jim Creel in the past, and he does such a fantastic job, both very informative and witty at the same time. So I think you're going to enjoy today's conversation. Jim is a consultant out of Jim Creel Consulting. He has a history of providing leadership trainings at the Blandin Foundation, which is located here in Minnesota. And he works a lot with our office on leadership trainings and building effective community partnerships. And we couldn't wait to bring him onto a call to meet all of you via phone and share some of his wisdom. We'll be talking about building effective community partnerships today, and Jim provided a nice handout. Do folks have that handout in front of them?
Yes.
Great. And with that, I'll turn things over to you, Jim.
Okay. Thank you, Cammy. And it's nice to meet all of you on a sunny Monday afternoon. And you're all looking just fine. Thank you. Just a couple of quick things. Hope you do have the little handout in front of you. The agenda I'd like to follow is I'd like to walk through this with you. And we will try and save some time for questions and comments at the end. But as we're going along, you know, if you've got a comment or a question or whatever, ask you just to jump in and raise the question when it occurs to you, because that's probably the best time to deal with it. So I can't read your body language to see if you're got a question or not, so I'll trust your good skills to say, well, hey, wait a minute, Jim. And feel free to say, you know, things like, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard. you know, whatever occurs to you that will be helpful. Don, was it you that just had a senior graduate from high school? Yeah, that's really
okay.
Cool.
Okay, sorry. I thought I had you muted, but I didn't have you muted. So, yes, it was me.
Okay. Well, the reason I say that is I was just talking to a friend of mine, obviously a much younger friend than I, who was commenting. They just had their senior graduate from college, and he said, I have come to that perfect point in life. I am free. And I said, what do you mean? He said, the last pet died. My last kid is done with school. I'm a free person. I thought, okay, I think that's a certain amount of truth to that. Well, anyway, we are going to talk a little bit about building effective community partnerships. And the material I gave you and the stuff I'll walk through with you really could be applied to any partnership that you're developing in the community or want to develop in the community, or a partnership that you've got going on with some other agency or group that needs some tending to. But what I'm going to ask you to do in light of my conversation with Cammy is I'm going to ask you to apply it, at least in our conversation this afternoon, to partnerships that you have to or want to establish to increase awareness of the special needs of veterans regarding end-of-life care in your community and in your area. And that's and as we go through the little workbook, I'll be asking you to think about that in particular. But as I said before, this material might be helpful for you and for the folks you work with, including the volunteers you work with, about developing partnerships in the community. So if you'd look at, I think it's actually page 2, past the cover. I'm going to focus on what I call 3 strategies for building effective community partnerships. And the 3 things I'm going to emphasize over and over again are the 3 strategies are making it meaningful, making the partnership meaningful, making the partnership manageable, and making the partnership productive. So it's MMP. I couldn't come up with an I to do MMPI for those of you that are into psychological testing. But the 3 strategies we're going to look at is meaning-making, making it manageable, and making it productive. So in the starting point I have with building partnerships or collaborations of any kind is at least I always need to remind myself that the partnership is not an end in and of itself. You know, partnerships are a good thing and they may fit our values, but they are a means to an end. They are not an end in and of themselves. So the first question always is when I'm working with communities or working with an organization, they say, well, we need to form partnerships or we need to form a partnership. The first question I always ask and I ask people to ask themselves or agencies to ask themselves is, so what will this partnership allow you to do better than if you try to do it by yourself? Partnerships take time. They take energy. All of us have enough to do. As this conversation was getting started, we're chatting a little bit about we're busy and we're good busy. Our plates are full. There are folks who can't be on this call because they're busy right now. So if we're going to engage in partnerships, what are they going to do? What's any particular partnership going to do to make it easier for us to do something that we could be doing alone? Okay, so that's always the first question to come up with. And in that, then, I would invite you to look at the first question under making it meaningful. Clearly identify the benefits of this partnership. What's the purpose? And the first question under that is, what is the purpose of the partnership? And those purposes can vary, obviously, in the case of dealing with palliative care. It is to create and increase awareness of the special needs of veterans regarding the end-of-life care in rural communities. And as we go on, we want to tease out a little bit about what does that look like in real life. So what does it mean to raise awareness? What's important about that? But that's the first piece you need to clarify, and you need to start that clarity with yourself and within your organization. You got to be able to have a quick answer to, so why are we doing this? You know, what's the purpose? How will we know? And then we'll talk a little bit later about how we know we're achieving the purpose. So once you've identified that, and sometimes, you know, that just seems so obvious. Well, it's to do thus and such. And my encouragement is write it down. Circulate it to 3 people and look at it again the next day. Does it still make sense? Can you explain it? Does it really give you more than if you just try to do whatever it is you're going to do on your own? And once you're comfortable with that, and in this case, you know, I think the purpose of the partnerships is pretty clear. The second question I ask people to ask themselves or organizations to ask themselves is, how will this partnership benefit your organization? What will it help you to do better? And the concept of benefit sometimes is a little tricky. So what is the benefit for us? What will it allow us to do better now? If this is the purpose, what is it specifically is going to be the benefit for us? Is it going to cost? Is it going to save us time? Are we going to be able to meet our mission better? In other words, it's the importance question. Why is this important to us? What will we get out of this? And it's okay to ask that. Everybody's got something else they can be doing. You can be using your resources someplace else. So what's the benefit or the benefits of doing this? And as you think about that, as you think about the partnerships around increasing awareness of the special needs, end-of-life needs of veterans and their end-of-life care, What's the benefit to you? What does it allow you to do better? And as you think about it, you might even jot down a note to yourself now about how do you answer that question? Okay. Key piece. And so many times I deal with organizations say, well, you know, we just kind of got into it, and I'm not so sure that it's worthwhile. Well, if you can't answer that question at the beginning, it probably won't be worthwhile. And then the third question, of course, is very simple. Specifically, whom do you want to form partnerships with? And here at this stage, I'm going to ask you to identify for yourself as we walk through this little workbook. Who do you want to identify as someone or an agency that you want to form a partnership around this business of increasing awareness of end of life needs? And it could be somebody that you want to initiate a partnership with. It could be somebody that you want to enhance the partnership with. But I'm going to ask you to pick somebody just for the purpose of this exercise. And, of course, the question always is, in real time, real life, why these particular partners? Okay, what is it about them that makes you think they would be good partners? We'll get to, as we get farther into the workbook, we'll talk about how they might look at it. Okay, so what's the purpose of the partnership? How will this partnership benefit your organization? What will allow you to do better than you could do on your own, given your mission, given your purpose, given your resources? What's the benefit? Who do you want to form partnerships with, and why them from your perspective? And then the fourth question you'll notice at the bottom of that page is, what do you see as the benefit for the other partners? And I want you to think about that for just a little bit. When you think about the partnerships you're dealing with, what do you see as the benefit for other partners? And you notice the approach here is a little different. Sometimes when we talk about forming partnerships, we say, well, you know, have they got a resource we need? In this case, well, they know a lot about veterans, or they have a lot of contact with veterans, or we're going to contact the local VFW because that's where the vets all hang out. Yes, that's fine. But you notice this approach about building relationships, and it's talking about building effective community relationships and partnerships, is looking at it and saying, what's the benefit for them? The partnerships that last have clear benefit for all partners. So it's not starting with, what can we get from our partners? It's how will the partnership benefit them, at least from your perspective? Now, as we go on, you may find that your answer to how the partnership will benefit them and their answer to that may be somewhat different, and that's okay. Not everybody gets the same things out of partnerships. First four questions make sense to you? Any questions? Any comments? Joni, Don, anybody?
No, I'm clear with that.
Okay.
I am too.
Okay. Do you get somebody in mind for that third question that you can use for this?
Yes.
Okay, good. I'm going to ask you then to flip to page two. Page two. I've always wanted to be Paul Harvey. Page two. Now, I don't know that you're running into any resistance. You may or may not, but having been doing this for a while, every once in a while, there's somebody who doesn't see the brilliance of what we're proposing. I presume it was some childhood error on their mother's part that made them less brilliant than we want them to be. And they kind of look at you and say, what are you talking about? Really, why do I want to do this? And so we want to pause on that for just a couple minutes, because resistance and reluctance in forming community partnerships is normal, okay? People are hesitant to engage in things that ask them to do things differently, or the benefit for them is not obviously clear, or for a whole lot of other reasons. And so I want to ask you to think just a little bit about dealing with reluctance and resistance for just a minute or two. And I'm going to start on the don't do it side first, okay? Over the years, I find that there's probably three or four sort of typical reactions that sometimes we fall into when somebody is resisting our invitation to join in a partnership, where we come to them and say, you know, we'd like to work with you on, or however you approach it. And these things can are easy to fall into. We're often not aware of them, but they are very counterproductive. And one of the first things about dealing with reluctance and resistance is don't try to break it down. Okay. Sometimes we approach it and say, well, I'm going to, and we literally will at times use that language. Well, I need to break down the resistance. I need to wear it down, you know, and we can come across as threatening. Not any of us would do that. It can feel to the other party like we're coercing them. You know, you really need to do this. Those of us who are true Midwesterners are sometimes good at trying to guilt other people. You know, you really should do this. I mean, if you really want to, you know, whatever the language is, or we end up overselling the benefits of the partnership and what it can do. So that reaction of, well, I've got to wear them down, I've got to break them down, I've got to really sell this thing, sometimes is more counterproductive than it is productive. So as you think about dealing with resistance, that might be one of the checkpoints for you. The second thing that I often see in dealing with reluctance is we put our blinders on and we just kind of avoid it. We just kind of pretend it isn't there. We ignore it. If I don't pay any attention to it, if I act as if, it will go away. Okay. Those of my colleagues in up in Duluth will recognize that, of course, is the good Minnesota way. We just pretend it doesn't happen. And we just say, well, that's interesting. And then we kind of go on our merry way. And we really don't listen. You know, we get very, very focused, and we don't acknowledge and we don't prepare ourselves to deal with the reality of the reluctance or the resistance. And the third thing that often happens is we discount it. Well, they really don't feel that way. It's really not a problem. You know, oh, it's not that significant of a deal. You know, once they get used to the idea, they'll go along with it. Again, those are traps that we can fall into, sometimes knowingly, sometimes unknowingly. So you might just check yourself when you experience resistance to any kind of change, but particularly around forming community partnerships. Do you feel yourself falling into that kind of stuff? What I'm going to suggest on page 3, when addressing reluctance and resistance, which is normal. It's not because somebody's mean-spirited or we're not doing a good job or they're not doing a good job. It's just normal part of life. I'm going to suggest 4 steps, and then some of the material we'll cover afterwards will give us some tools for addressing resistance. But the first thing I would suggest and encourage in dealing with reluctance and resistance is surfacing it, dealing with the reality, letting people talk about it. And sometimes it can be very difficult. And if for those of us that live in smaller communities, dealing with differences of opinion, dealing with concerns sometimes can be uncomfortable, as we have lots of overlapping relationships and we know each other in a lot of circumstances and we see each other around town. In the community, in a lot of different circumstances, anything that strikes us as difference or disagreement of any kind can be uncomfortable. So one of the first things to do if you experience reluctance and resistance is make it safe and easy for you and for the other party to talk about it. Okay. Just let them know that you want to know about why this is difficult for them, why you don't think this might be working for them. And you know, one of the techniques I sometimes use is when I lay out something like that, I'll say, not what do you think of it, but I'll often invite them to say, so is there something about this that would be problematic for you? Okay, so get that out of the way. And as you hear that, this thing about making it safe and easy, as you're listening to that, don't trivialize it, don't argue with it, don't attack it, and at that point of the game, don't try and correct it. Say, well, that's really not true. You know, we're really going to do it this way. Listen to them, and my encouragement is listen to understand, okay? And if you think about how we use our listening skills, so many times we listen for agreement. I listen for those things I agree with, or I listen for those things I disagree with. In this case, in terms of surfacing why people might be reluctant or resistant to form the partnership, I listen to understand. What is it that they're really saying? What is their concern? And instead of investing a lot of time in right now on how I'm going to answer that, or in my case, how I'm going to straighten them out on this, it's listen to understand. Okay, and the more you do that, the easier it is for them, the safer it is for them. And go ahead and ask for it all. You know, when they're done, they say, okay, you know, is there anything else that concerns you? Let's talk about it. Because if you don't know about it, you can't deal with it. So surfacing it, making it safe and easy, asking for it all. And then step B is acknowledging what you heard. You know, it's that thing about giving feedback, about paraphrasing. This is what I hear. You're concerned about how much time and energy it'll take. You're concerned about, and again, you notice at this point, it's letting them know that they've been heard and understood rather than giving them the answer. So that they really get a sense of, yes, you do understand. And yes, you get what I'm saying. Point C is clarifying. And that's part of acknowledging, but you notice under clarifying, I have two subpoints. It says, direct reluctance and resistance, indirect reluctance and resistance. Sometimes you'll find that people are resistant or hesitant or reluctant to join a community partnership to work with you on something because they don't understand or they don't like what you're doing. So that's what we call direct reluctance or resistance. They're resistant to what you're proposing and what it is that you want to do. On the I shouldn't say on the other hand, but sometimes part of that is also what we call indirect reluctance. They've had a bad experience. You know, somebody talked us into a partnership and we were going to collaborate on this or we were going to help them with us this and they were going to help us with that, and it never happened. We've had a lot of promises from other people. You know, we've had people in the medical community tell us this, and the VA has told us that, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what they're resisting is not necessarily what you're proposing. What they're resisting is their experience of partnerships or collaboration or working with various kinds of agencies in the past. And that's important stuff for you to know, because you may then have to separate out what it is that you're doing from what they've experienced in the past. So first four steps are about letting it come out, identifying what it is, acknowledging what it is, getting a sense of, is there reluctance and resistance about what you're proposing? To what extent is it that? To what extent is it a reflection of past experience that you've had? Then, and we're going to move to this later on, after you've had that acknowledging and clarifying conversation or conversations, that's when you can start this business of, well, let me go over again what it is that I'm proposing or we're proposing as the partnership and how that addresses the concerns that you have. We'll be talking in a couple of minutes about making it manageable, about making it productive. When you can answer some of those kinds of questions in light of what their concerns are, you're probably going to experience that resistance or that reluctance to move away rather quickly. Once they felt that they've been heard, you understand what their concerns are, and you can address those specifically in terms of what you're proposing. So when you look at A, B, and C, and then I would insert in there a little asterisk or a little mark, and you might say, here's the point in which I have some input based on the kinds of questions I found in the workbook. And then point D, in terms of dealing with reluctance, is about moving on. It's about saying, you know, I can only invest so much time and energy in this, and after we've explained it and we've had some good conversation or conversations, we do need to move on. And what we have here are 4 points on what I call the levels of agreement scale. And let me just talk with you for just a minute or two about that. Again, it's something that you might find useful in a whole variety of settings, but here we're going to talk about it in terms of dealing with community partnerships. The first point on this moving on scale or this level of agreement scale is rejection. And rejection is no. I don't like the idea. You know, don't call me, don't call us, we'll call you. Watch the forecast. When Hades freezes over, I'll call you. It is just saying no. I don't want anything to do with it. I really reject it. Disagreement usually means I disagree with some part of it. There's some part of it that I can't live with or I can't deal with. It may be the way it's framed. It may be what the outcome is. It may be what you're asking from me. So I don't reject the idea. I disagree about the way you're approaching it, or I disagree with what you're asking me to do because I can't deal with that, or I can't do that. Those are two significant different responses. And sometimes we hear them as the same thing. Oftentimes we hear disagreement as rejection. Those are two very different things. If somebody really rejects you or your idea or this particular proposal, it's less likely that you're going to be able to find some common ground with them to engage in this partnership as time goes on. Disagreement, if that's really where they're at, and if you've really listened and you've had a good conversation, suggests that maybe there's some things I can change. Maybe it's a matter of timing. But there is a greater likelihood than with rejection that somewhere along the line you'll be able to develop a working partnership with these folks. So, again, it's a trap that we sometimes fall into. The next 2 points, agreement and commitment. Agreement says, that's a good idea. I like it. Yep, that's a great idea. You know, gosh, you're brilliant, and that's really helpful for us, and I really like it. We agree it's a good idea. Commitment says, we really like it. It's a good idea. I really like where you're going with this. This is a really good thing, and we will act on it. One of the big dangers sometimes in forming partnerships is that we confuse agreement with commitment. Somebody says, yes, that's a good idea, and we say, glory, hallelujah, they're going to work on this, they're going to cooperate with us, okay, whoopee. And we also find that in community life, you know, we'll be working with a group of people, and we'll say, everybody agree with this? And say, yeah, okay, well, we'll meet next Tuesday, and next Tuesday, two people show up, and we have to remind ourselves that we didn't ask people to commit to show up, we just asked if you agreed with it, and we confused agreement with commitment. So, As you think about the partnerships you're working on and where you're experiencing reluctance and resistance, the difference between rejection and disagreement, the difference between agreement and commitment. Last 2 questions on that page. What will you do to help your potential partners identify how the partnership will benefit them? Remember on the page just before, on page 2, we said, what do you see as the benefit for your potential partners? How will they benefit from it? The question now that I would invite you to think about is, how are you going to help them identify the benefit? What kind of conversation will you have with them as you lay out the purpose and the benefit for you? How will you help them do that? And then the third question is on this page. If you're currently experiencing reluctance or resistance from a potential partner, what will you do to address it? Again, being intentional and thinking about the 4 steps in dealing with reluctance and resistance. Okay, that's the first strategy, or some highlights for the first strategy about making it meaningful. What's the purpose? What are the benefits? What are some ways of dealing with resistance? Any questions, any comments at this stage of the game?
for me.
Hey.
Okay.
You can sit.
Did somebody else just come in?
Linda Todd.
Hey, Linda. Welcome.
Thanks.
Okay. So we just had somebody join us?
Yes, Linda Todd from Sioux City.
Hey, Linda. Linda, do you have the material that we sent you?
Yes, I sure do.
Okay. We are on page 4, right?
Okay.
Just so you know, Linda, there's a test afterwards, but we don't.
Okay, I'll try to memorize.
Yeah, try to memorize. Try and color between the lines while you're at it. Okay. Linda, what we're talking about is in terms of building effective community partnerships is we're looking at three key strategies, making the partnership meaningful, making it manageable, and making it productive. And we talked a little bit in the first piece about making it meaningful and what do we have to do to, or some things we might do to make these partnerships meaningful. Second piece we want to look at is what I call making it manageable. And my concern, or my point here is that everybody's got a lot of stuff going on their plates. Every organization is more than enough to do and hardly ever enough resources, if ever enough resources, to do all we want to do. So you're asking me now to form some sort of partnership with you, or I'm thinking about forming some sort of partnership with somebody else. How do I make it manageable? If I've got enough, if my plate is already full, how am I going to do this? And how am I going to join with you in doing this? And one of the key things that I see with partnerships that don't last very long is that the cost of doing the partnership ends up being greater than the benefit of the partnership. So,
can we have people mute their phones if they're not speaking? We've got a lot of background noise. Thank you.
Yeah.
The joys of life. Yeah. Well, making it manageable in some ways. It's a great illustration because in some ways making it manageable means also tuning out some of the background noise we have to deal with in our organizations, in our lives to stay focused on this partnership. So again, if you look at page 4, making it manageable. As individuals and organizations, we all have enough to do. Partnerships, no matter how noble their purpose, take time and effort. The cost of being in a partnership should not be experienced as greater than the benefits. Keeping the partnership manageable for all parties involved keeps the costs down. And so I want to talk just a little bit about that. First thing, of course, is be clear on what's required for the partnership to achieve its purpose and provide its benefits. Okay. If you're going to go into a partnership, whether you're initiating it or you're inviting somebody else in or you're accepting an invitation to join a partnership, what's it going to take? So what will your organization do as a partner? What will it require of you to do this? And be specific about that. What will your organization do? Are we going to send out newsletters? Are we going to organize meetings? Are we going to go to meetings? Are we going to be responsible for following up on emails? Are we going to deliver direct service? What is your organization going to do as a partner? And being clear and specific. And you'll notice when we talk about dealing with reluctance and resistance just a couple of minutes ago, being able to answer those questions and being able to lay that out ahead of time. You know, here's what we're going to provide. Here's what we're going to do as partners. Helps lower resistance. People understand, okay, well, this is what somebody else is bringing to the game. Second piece for yourself, and as you think about these partnerships to increase awareness of special needs, end-of-life needs for veterans, what resources will it take for you to do this? If it's one more thing to do, what kind of staff time will it take? What kind of volunteer time? And there's really no such thing as volunteer time because volunteers need to be guided and managed. And even if they don't get paid, they still take staff time in terms of coordinating their activities. And are there finances involved, either in terms of salaries or expenses? So what resources will it take? And once you're clear on that, is asking ourselves the question, is there a limit on how much time, energy, or money your organization can commit to the partnership? If so, what's that limit? And we're very good, especially in small organizations, say, well, we can make that work, which usually means it's going to come out of somebody's hide, usually the executive directors. So what's the limit? What limits do you have? And how will you communicate that to your partners? It's about setting boundaries, okay? And it keeps us from overselling the partnership. Don't oversell what you can do. Set some boundaries on it. And then, what are the other partners expected to do? Remember when we talked about resistance a little while ago? Being clear with them about, and here's what you would need to do. You need to provide us names. You need to go to meetings. You need to blah, 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 whatever it is. You need to contribute $100 every day. Whatever it is, what are they expected to do? And the second part of that, item number four, is what are their limits? And giving them a chance to say, we can only do so much. And they may need to go back and think about that. And they may need to talk to some other folks in the organization. They may need to go back to their budgets. They need to have some counsel of some sort that they need to check with. But let them know that it's okay to say, here's what we can do, here's what we can't do. Okay? That process of dialogue and directed questions, saying, here's what we can do, here's what we can't do, giving your partners or your potential partners a chance to clarify what's expected of them and give them an opportunity to say, here's what our limits are. And setting limits is not a form of resistance. Some tips for making it manageable. Things to keep in mind as you go along. Stay focused. Okay? What's your purpose? What are your benefits that come to the partners? Stay focused on that. Okay? There's a great opportunity sometimes for mission creep in community partnerships. And sometimes that's healthy. We started out talking about being aware of end-of-life needs of veterans, and over the years it grew too. X, Y, and Z. That's good and that's healthy. At the beginning of a partnership in particular, however, that can kill a partnership. All of a sudden, we're expecting each other to do things, or we're adding tasks or burdens, or somebody gets a great idea, as long as we're in a partnership with them, what if we co-hosted blah, blah, blah? And we lose focus, it becomes unmanageable, and we back away. The other piece that I would encourage folks, what's the old line? How do you eat an elephant? Well, you eat it one bite at a time. Sometimes we need to think strategically about, in this partnership, what can we do at this time? What's manageable? What's realistic for us? And we don't necessarily have to get everything done all at the same time. That may be less applicable in this case, more applicable in other partnerships that you have. And then the last tip is think about leverage activities. And by leverage activities, and it's part of eating the elephant at one time, it's the thing of saying, okay, if we do this, if we set up this kind of a routine, or if we address this issue, or we commit to this kind of activity, we're going to meet twice a week, and we're going to address communication about how we identify veterans' needs and how we get word to veterans, and we're going to develop a communication strategy. Lay that out into chunks. What is it that we have to do in order for that to happen so it doesn't overwhelm us? I said eating that elephant at one time. And then figuring out, if we do this activity, if we create a committee, for example, or if we create a website, what will that allow us to do in the future? Okay. So making it manageable, it's like climbing the ladder one step at a time. I'll use the website notion. I'm just dealing with a partnership group, not on this topic, but on another community issue. dealing with a health and safety issue in the community, and they came up with this great idea that they're going to develop this website, you know, and it just, two small organizations in a small community, just blew them away. They didn't know how they were going to do that and should they do that. So what we did is we just unpacked it and said, well, before we get to a website, let's talk about what kind of information people need. Where do people get information now? Do we even need a website? You know, does that already exist? Just laying it out in chunks like that, they were able to get a handle on it. And as it turned out, they did not need to create a new website. All they needed to do was participate in one that a local hospital had already created for a similar topic. So making it manageable sometimes means we have to step back and take a look at what we're doing, lay it out step at a time. Page 5, making things manageable, also talks about managing communication. And my tagline always is about communication, whether it's between my wife and I or between organizations in the community. The biggest danger in communication is the assumption that we've communicated. At home, you know, our tagline here is, but I told you. Okay. Or didn't you read the note I left? As if we could stand one more note on the refrigerator to advise each other where we're going and what we're doing and what we've committed each other to. Two of the biggest danger in communication is when we're dealing with partnerships is I thought you meant. So one of the things I would suggest as you think about communication in your partnerships, particularly if it is about raising awareness and keeping people posted on information that they need, is being able to answer this first question as you go along. In order for a partnership to be effective and manageable, you need to know who needs information, okay, and that who can be you or it can be your partner, who needs what information, what is it that they need to know, and keep in mind that people are awash in information. You know, so it's not just what is interesting, but given the purpose of the partnership, who needs to know what information, by when, for what purpose? And if you can be conscious of that, if you can think about managing your communication with your partners in terms of who in the partnership needs to know this, or which partner needs to know this, or which partners need to know this information, by when, for what purpose, it just saves a lot of time and energy. It gives some purpose and direction to your communication. It makes your communication manageable. And for those people who are receiving the communication, they say, oh, this must be important because they don't send me stuff I don't need or want. Okay? And let's keep in mind that some of us have different personalities in terms of how much information we need and the way we get information. Some of us love tons of information, related and unrelated. Others of us simply say, give me the bottom line. What is it that I need to know? If you're going to err on the side of communication in a partnership, my encouragement is err on the side of making sure people have what they need to know for the purposes of the partnership. If you want to add other stuff from time to time, okay, but keep that communication focused. The second piece, and I don't know if this applies to you or not, I included it because I find that this gets to be a problem for some folks. Don't know that it applies to you. I'm going to walk through it quickly. If there's something useful in here for you, please feel free to make use of it. If you've got some questions about it, please feel free to ask. But I'm a sociologist by training, and I sometimes find myself helping folks deal with different communication cultures. And cultures, when we talk about communication cultures, I'm talking about the way we communicate and the styles of communication that we have, not as individuals, but as groups. And sometimes, especially when forming partnerships with larger organizations than we are, they can be locally or outside the area, is there are some significant differences between the way we communicate in bureaucracies and the way we communicate in the communities. So if you look at question A under communication cultures on page 5, What are the differences in the way you communicate in your community and the way communication takes place in large agencies and organizations? Anybody any thoughts on that? What differences do you see in the way that you communicate in your community and the way communication takes place in large agencies or organizations?
Jim?
Yeah.
Sally, I think one thing from the center's perspective of communicating with our VA contractor, the BISN, I think our culture has been to you copy everyone who might have an interest in the project and make sure everyone's hearing the information and finding out, you know, quickly within the VA that it's, you know, kind of the chain of command follows, or communication has followed the chain of command, so they don't want to all hear the information at the same time. It's like you'll be notified by this person who has this position, and it's kind of a need-to-know basis.
Yeah. Yeah, and their need to know may be different than your need to know.
Yes, our need to approve.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we've been walking the communities through that too, in terms of not only certainly their partnerships with other healthcare providers and social service and veterans community organizations like VFW, but with the actual Veterans Affairs medical centers and the CBOX.
Yeah. Yeah, Sally, that's very helpful. Here's just a couple of things, and I'll build on that if I can, from my experience and working with folks. First of all, bureaucracies, particularly government bureaucracies, and particularly government bureaucracies related to the military, certainly have a chain of command. Okay. And communication tends not to be inclusive. It tends to be very focused. You got to get the right information to the right person at the right time. That's when you go back to the question above, who needs what information by when for what purpose when you're communicating into that system. Communication within bureaucracies and with bureaucracies usually involves a lot of jargon. They develop inside language and initials and acronyms that you need a guidebook for. Decision-making tends to come slower and from different levels, and it's not always clear who gets to, at least to outsiders, who gets to make what decisions when. Those things that we sometimes think that we've all agreed to have to be passed up the chain of command to someone who was not part of the conversation, but who will make the decision. And so it's just, it's a much more complicated, much more formal communication system. And so my suggestion is when we're dealing with bureaucracies that are different than the communities we come from, or bureaucracies that are even larger than our own if we belong to bureaucracies, I suggest people look for or develop both within their own organization and if they can find them within the bureaucracy they're dealing with, what I call questioners, map readers, and translators. Okay. And questioners are those folks either in the bureaucracy you're dealing with or in your own team who are good at asking the clarifying questions and getting the details. Okay. On our part, from not being part of the bureaucracy, who in your team, or is it yourself, who's good at saying, so who do I need to talk to get this? Specifically, what has to happen? What form do I need? When does that have to happen? Okay. But getting that level of specificity, or asking the specific question, I need X, Y, and Z, who do I talk to? Okay. Who are those questioners? on your side. And sometimes if you're used to dealing with if you develop a pattern of relationship with the bureaucracy, you'll find somebody who is a good questioner, who will ask you those questions. Build on those people, use them. Second kinds of folks that I look for when dealing with the bureaucracy is who are the good map readers? Okay, and by map readers, I mean who are those folks who that you can talk to or are in your organization who are good at figuring out all those layers of communication? Who's good at knowing who you call for what purpose? Remember, this, they don't practice inclusive communication. Who do you call for what purpose? Who can get you through the website in less than 32 clicks? You know, who knows who knows the trick of keeping pushing zero until you get to talk to a person and you get past the machines? Who are the good map readers? And again, sometimes you'll find those folks within the bureaucracy who will be able to tell you, okay, you need to call such and such, or you need to go to such and such link. Or you have those people who have those kinds of skills in your own organization. And then the last group I often talk about are translators. Who are the people who can tell you what it really means? Okay, there's a set of regulations in Section C-17, Article B, Item 7-4, says, and you know, and I read that, and according to that, if you have your appendix taken out by a wild boar on the plains of Oklahoma, you qualified for these benefits. I need somebody to translate that into English for me to say, no, what that really means is if you're on da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you have this kind of benefit. Who within the bureaucracy can translate for you? Who in your organization is good at translating? Again, the biggest danger in communication is the assumption of it. The biggest danger in communicating with a bureaucracy is the assumption that we've got communication taking place. So spending some time identifying those questioners, map readers, and translators can certainly be worth it. Okay. We've talked a little bit about making it meaningful. We've talked about making it manageable in terms of focus, in terms of communication, in terms of what's required of us and what's required of our partners. The last piece I'm going to invite you to think a little bit about is on page 6, and that's making it productive. And what I'm going to ask you to think about here as you think about the partnerships that you have and the particular partners that you're working with around end-of-life care for veterans is the concept of making it productive. And here, you know, we're pretty good at making things happen. You wouldn't be doing the kind of work you're doing if you weren't good at making things productive. My point here is helping yourself and others in the partnership recognizing what productivity or success looks like. Because a lot of times I'll work with groups that are in partnerships in community, and they're really very productive. What they haven't come to is a way to measure that productivity and be aware of what they, in fact, are and are not accomplishing. So what I'm going to suggest are some things that might help you in terms of monitoring and measuring and celebrating your productivity. And we're going to talk about indicators of success or indicators of productivity that will enable you to make realistic judgments about what is and is not being accomplished, what needs to be changed, and what needs to be celebrated. And I'm going to suggest that productivity involves two things. First of all, the product, what gets done, okay? And it's what gets done that achieves the purpose of the partnership. So what will tell you that you're achieving the purpose of the partnership in terms of the product? And even when you're talking about raising awareness, increasing awareness, what does that look like? How will you know? And then because a partnership is a relationship, the other measure of productivity is the process. Process is how it gets done. And in this case, productive process means that the partners feel valued, accepted, and important to getting it done, which means they're going to be more willing to continue the partnership or expand the partnership as time goes on. So you look at both product and process. What are we getting done that achieves the purpose of the process? and what processes are we using? How are we managing the relationship so that we all feel valued, accepted, and important to getting it done, and we'll hang in there. Some things to look for indicators of productivity or success. First of all, obviously, your indicators of productivity should be linked to the purpose and the benefits. Okay, why are you doing this? How will you know? What will increased awareness look like? How will you know that that's happening? Are there certain behaviors that will change? Are there going to be a certain flow in information? Will you be able to track people who are getting services or different services? Getting services they're not getting now, or they're getting services in a different way, or they're getting them at a lower cost. What's the consequence of awareness? What does it look like? So link to purpose and benefits, lead and lag indicators. Lead and lag indicators means simply that there are different things going on at different times. And remember, we talked about leverage activities. If we get this done, that means we're going to be able to do something else. Lead indicators are those things that we have to get done first so that we get the outcomes we're looking for. And let's say the outcome you're looking for, and I don't know if this is true in this case, but the outcome we're looking for, let's say, is a greater number of people going in for preventative care of early checkups on a particular health issue. And that's what our partnership is about. Okay, one of the lead indicators would be we've developed a partnership with clear rules and responsibilities and methods of communication. That would be a lead indicator. The lag indicator is we're starting to see the needle move in terms of the number of folks who are coming in for early treatment or preventative treatment, immunization or whatever, around this particular health issue. So productivity, both in terms of lead indicators and lag indicators. Those things that happen first so that things can happen later. And then indicators of productivity should allow you to monitor, communicate, learn, adjust, and celebrate. I monitor, how are we going to keep track of it? How are we going to communicate results? As I said earlier, so many times partnerships are productive, but we say, well, what have we done lately? I mean, what has the partnership done for us lately? And if we're not monitoring and communicating those results, that's harder to answer. They'll help us to, obviously, monitoring and indicators of success and productivity help us to learn and adjust our behaviors, and they give us things to celebrate. So as you look at developing partnerships, that last question, C, for partnerships you want to create or strengthen, what are the product and process indicators of productivity for you? Okay, in terms of what gets done and how it gets done, what would success look like for you? What will it look like for your partners? And then how will you monitor progress? How will you communicate the results to each other? How will you make adjustments when needed? And how will you celebrate your success? Okay, our time is drawing to a close. Lots of stuff that I tossed at you. It's like sitting in front of a fire hydrant with your mouth open on a nice warm spring or summer afternoon. Any questions, any concerns, any comments about any of this?
Very easy to understand.
Make sense to you?
Yes.
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yes.
Have you got a spot? Have you got a spot you can use it?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
And I'm sorry I wasn't on mute earlier, but I must have pressed the button, and I have my family with me, so I apologize. I kind of have some issues with resistance with even the Veterans Service Officers wanting to get involved with us to come to their office or, you know, something close to their neighborhood or in their community to present the information that we have for these veterans and then just lack of wanting, they don't seem to want to get involved. And I wonder if it's how I'm approaching it. I've been told different things about, well, if they want to, you know, want to get this information out to them. Why don't you get their addresses and mail the stuff to them? Well, that's not what we want to do. We want to do person-to-person discussion with them so they can ask questions and we can respond. So does anybody have any suggestions about how to approach these veteran service officers to get more of a vested buy-in on what we're trying to do?
Okay. Anybody want to weigh in on that?
You have an understanding of the barriers or why they don't want to become involved? Do you get a sense of that?
I feel like a lot of them just don't want to take the time. And, you know, when I said I'd like to come, you know, have you give me some, you know, suggestions about community centers, senior centers, places that I can contact specialists. You know, if we can't come to your office or meeting hall, where we can do that. I've had them say, well, I don't know. A few have been quite helpful with, you know, hey, call the senior center, those types of things, but nothing that's really been earth-shattering or even very helpful. I've had one that's been really, really helpful, but she had a health problem. So I've gotten the information to her, and I'm going to touch base with her again, but she seems to be quite excited about bringing this information to her veterans. But other than that, I really haven't gotten a hold of anybody that seems really excited about it. Some haven't even returned my phone calls. So I don't know if this is the correct realm to talk about this, but we kind of talked about partnerships and stuff. So I just wanted to get some feedback from you guys to see if you had the same difficulties that I have.
Yeah. This is Jim. Just a couple of things that strike me. My own experience with veteran service officers and they, like any other profession or job, they cover the spectrum. For some of them, particularly some of those that have been in the position for a long time, you're asking them to change behaviors, and that's very difficult for them to do, especially if the benefit is not readily apparent to them. You know, they're doing their jobs, and their job is doing just fine. So thank you. So getting past that hurdle of seeing how it will help them or help the people they serve can be a real issue. Gender, quite honestly, gender bias can be an issue in some cases. One of the things you might think about, I don't know if it will work in your situation, but I'm going on some past experience here, is if there is someone that you know who has some clout with that veteran service officer, whether it's through state government or county government, some colleague, some leader in a veterans organization who might run interference for you, at least my past experiences, that can be very helpful. The veteran service officer that's helpful to you, can she leverage some action with some of those folks that are less cooperative? But you may need some sort of third party or outside force to help nudge them along. It may not be anything that you're doing or not doing that's getting in the way.
Okay, well, I'm going to keep trying to have a face-to-face visit with that service officer, the one who's been most accommodating, and see if maybe it's a female, so I'm not sure, you know, how she can help you in the male area, but she may, you know, be friends with a couple of other ones that may, you know, open their door more so than what they have in the past.
Exactly.
So thank you very much.
Oh, that's a great question.
We wondered, the one that we're trying to meet with is very busy, and she's had a lot of things going on in her personal life, too. So we just wondered if they were very busy people, usually, maybe limited resources in their offices.
My experience is that's pretty descriptive. high demand, low resources. And a lot of the things that, at least my experience with veteran service offices, depending on where they are and the age of the population, sometimes they're dealing with a lot of things that have a sense of urgency about them with particular individuals. And so broader issues like getting word out or holding meetings and like that just seem less urgent to them.
Tony, this is Cammie here. Did you identify what the benefit was for the CVSOs in partnering with you? And if so, what was that benefit that the CVSOs saw or that you saw in partnering with the CVSOs?
Well, for one, knowing where to go if we do need to identify some resources for veterans who haven't been signed up for veteran benefits yet or aren't as connected in. So we had hoped that partnering with that person might make us a little more educated about what they do, and therefore we could serve our patients a little bit better.
Okay, thanks.
But it does raise, that raises a good question from the CSO's perspective. What's the benefit to them in that? It help you serve your patients better or your clients better. What's the payoff for that officer, that service officer?
Well, we discussed that too, that they would be aware of our what our services are to people that they might come across that might need end of life care.
Okay. Did they see that as a problem right now? Is that something that's on their screen?
Erica has had some conversations with ours on the phone mostly. We tried meeting with her, and it was just different things that would come up. But she said, yes, they do see that there are end-of-life issues that are out there.
Okay.
And they need to be met.
Yeah.
Any other comments or questions for Jim?
Going once, going twice.
This is Diane Jones, and I didn't introduce myself at the beginning. I've been lurking in the background, and I apologize for that.
Oh, my God, a lurker.
A genuine lurker.
Oh, no.
Anyway, I work with a lot of hospice veteran partnerships around the country and with veteran service officers as well. And I agree that there are a lot of demands on their times, and there is as you would expect in any kind of organization, a varying degree of commitment to the job, getting the job done. Some of the veteran service officers are volunteers. Some of them work part-time. Some of them may not have a whole lot of training. So, you know, there are a number of factors that go into it. But it's just been my experience that when hospices approach the veteran service officers as individual organizations, there may be the perception on the part of the VSO that it is more about marketing the hospice services than it is about making sure that the veteran is accessing the benefits.
Sure.
So it may be helpful to, rather than to approach the VSO on a one-on-one basis between hospices and the VSO, and to perhaps approach the VSO as an organization or your partnership, the hospice veteran partnership of Minnesota or of Iowa or something like that that may put it into a broader context that's part of a national program rather than I'm a hospice and I want to partner with you to do X. That's just a thought.
That's a great alternative way to start to frame it. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Diane.
Mm-hmm.
For that
very
perfect.
Helpful.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you, Jim. Provided some great insights and certainly framed it in a different format for us all. I think in terms of the approach and answering these questions ahead of the outreach. In terms of making it meaningful and manageable and productive. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yes, thank you.
Well, just a few updates from the PCRI project. Thank you all for sending in the outcome measures and invoices. The next quarterly period will end June 30th. And so we'll need the invoices and outcome measures for the second quarter by July 15th. And then we will also have another webinar in July. And also we wanted to have you save the dates. We'll be getting a notice out, I think, within a week to all of you. That on August 7th and 8th, we'll be holding a workshop just for the Vision 23 PCRI communities. We will be able to cover travel expenses for up to 3 participants from each of your teams in each community. And the purpose of the workshop will be to share additional resources with you. We'll have representatives from the National Hospice Palliative Care Organization, we hope. Also, Caroline, of course, from Vision 23 and Atlas Research, and we hope also from the VA Office of Rural Health. And the most importantly, we'll give you all time to share 15 minutes on each on your project and lessons learned and, future plans. And part of the technical assistance, too, of the workshop will be to help you with sustainability plans of going forward once the formal project is over and the funding from the VA. And so we're looking, again, running Tuesday, August 7th at noon through Wednesday, August 8th at noon 2. So kind of a noon to noon or noon to 1 there. And we'll send more information about that, but just wanted you all to be able to get that date on your calendars. And we hope that will work for you to each have at least one, if not 3, from each site to attend. And now, why don't we do some updates around Robin. I'll start with Hospice of Southwest Iowa. Joni, Erica?
Sure.
Stacy? Okay.
Well, we had our oversight visit last Tuesday, and Sally Trinka came in, and we were able to update her on our progress so far. We're still working on the Veteran Volunteer Manual. That's coming along very well. We are working on hiring a Veteran Volunteer Champion. We have at least one person in mind. He has some personal things going on in his life right now, and so we are still keeping in contact with him.
and we have developed a contract and a job description, a job description for the veteran volunteer and a contract for this position as the champion. We also discussed providing a presentation at the Iowa Hospice and Palliative Care Association. So that is in the process of being submitted. And then as far as recruiting and honoring of veterans, we showed Sally some of the items that we're using for our recognition and pinning ceremonies. And then also our bereavement, we produce a pillow. And along with that pillow, the pillow is made out of an article of clothing that the person wore, and something that's meaningful to them. And then Erica is putting a copy of, depending on which branch of the service that they served in, is putting a copy of the song, the branch's song, along with that.
Which they all know by heart, because we saw it in action.
We also had some bears that, they're almost like Beanie Babies, that were donated to us. And we are, those should typically get put into memory bags for children that have lost a loved one. And the bears are specific to different branches of the military. And
have a verse
with them as well. And so we are also looking to provide more of those and looking for ways that we can do that.
That sounds good. Really nice. Thank you. Great. Okay, and Dawn, let's host Connect in Grand Island.
Okay. We have just really started, just really kicked off our visiting and taking the idea and the veteran benefits out to senior centers throughout. So we have everything scheduled in our 26 counties. Out, I think, should be, our first round should be done by the middle of June or the end of June. And then we continue to try to make contact with the veteran service officers to get other opportunities to give information for benefits out to other areas. But our staff are really good about kind of talking to people and getting places, actually obtaining places for us to go and send our information, connecting with people at the meetings that we've already scheduled, and just generally just from out being in the public, talking with their neighbors and their friends. Hopefully our veterans we bring somebody on to get those out, having our ceremonies and presenting those pins, it seems to be very, very well received. Had a lot of good feedback on those types of activities. But other than that, we kind of get started with stuff. I really don't have a good support to get started.
Don, can you repeat the last part that you said you had good feedback on? Because it was breaking up a little bit.
Okay, we've had fabulous feedback on taking the certificates and the pins out to the veterans.
okay.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, that has made a huge impact on our patients and their families. We've had some very tearful, tearful events associated with that activity, and that's kind of, I mean, a highlight of what we're really going for, getting that information out there. But still, it's those stories and those experiences that we're getting to have with our patients, that our families are getting to have with patients, that the best for bringing out those certificates and those pins, et cetera.
That's great. Thank you. And Linda?
Are Marco and Melissa on the call?
Right.
No? Okay. There's been lots of activities in just the organization of
getting volunteers trained. There's been outreach out in the rural areas. There's a couple of champions, if you will, one in Plymouth County, which is to the north, and then there's a champion out in the Nebraska area that has really helped us connect with the American Legion. There's a VSO officer in the Plymouth County area that has been great help to Margot and Melissa as they are advancing the vet-to-vet program. So that's been just excellent. They have their training, their PowerPoint training combined with Deb Grassman's video, and have combined that, and that has been effective. We have linked up with the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, and now we'll be able to survey veterans and receive feedback when the family satisfaction surveys are returned. With the intake staff is asking when the person is referred, identifying veterans and getting them into our system. So that's very helpful with that. So lots of organization things have gone on, and just helping us as an organization even know what veterans are out there and who we're serving. And so excited about that, excited about the training. Have done training with some of our current volunteers, and then also preparing trainings with veterans out in the community to do a volunteer training.
Great, thanks. Any questions among the communities or with the communities? Linda, what size group do you anticipate for the training?
They're fairly, you know, there's probably, Margot would be better able to answer that question. I'm not sure. Probably small, you know, 8 to 10 maybe.
Mm-hmm. And are you finding, as they recruit the veteran volunteers, these tend to be folks that volunteer with other aspects?
Well, certainly active in the Legion and very strong supporters of, you know, the VA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really champions, and, you know, absolutely we should be supporting other veterans. I mean, I think that's what Margot has found.
But are they maybe new as volunteers in the healthcare system?
Yes. There's some volunteers that would be with hospice, and then there are ones that are outside of the healthcare system. So, I'm sorry, I can't give you the exact
okay.
numbers.
No, it's. Well, it's Sally who reported on your recruitment, and that's great that they're getting ready to train some new volunteers through the program as well as the recent training. Okay. Any other updates or questions? No. Thank you all.
Thank you for tuning in.
I know Lakewood. Unless someone from Lakewood came on during the call from Staples, Minnesota, but they have been doing quite a bit of outreach through health fairs and meeting with reaching out to nursing homes and other long-term care organizations about their services. And since they are developing our new model of palliative care services and reimbursement by the VA, we've had a series of calls with Caroline Schauer our contract officer, as well as the PA in St. Cloud, and working out the type of service and the reimbursement structure, and so that, since that is all new.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Well, thank you all for joining today, and again, we'll send out the recording link and the evaluation. I look forward to talking with you as a group in July, and hopefully seeing you all in August.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.